You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hi, everyone. I'm Rachel Bernstein from the Indoctrination Podcast, and I want to give you a quick heads up because I don't want you to miss something really special. Our next Patreon-exclusive Q&A is coming up on June 19th, and these sessions only happen every other month. Every time, the questions are so powerful, the conversations go deep, and the insights we share are things you won't hear anywhere else. If you've ever wanted to ask something about cults, something about your experience, something you've wanted to know that hasn't yet been answered out there, something you wanted to know about coercion, generally about manipulation, or the healing process after leaving a high-control group, this moment is for you. Question submissions end June 12th, so make sure your voice is part of it. Send your questions to indoctrinationshow@gmail.com and join us on Patreon so you don't miss out on this next Q&A. I'd really love to hear what's been on your mind. Take care.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Today on the show, we have a special guest named Rue Marshall, and I want to introduce Rue to you. Rue has been working on something for 20 years and wants to share it with us today. American Trickster is the name of a book that Rue has written. American Trickster, The Hidden Lives of Carlos Castaneda. This book unravels the story of the secretive faux anthropologist who pulled off one of the greatest literary hoaxes in modern history. Both an investigative journey into Carlos Castaneda and the techniques employed by charismatic narcissists, and a study of the cult dynamics that still shape American life. American Trickster defies conventional biography. It emerges as a chilling allegory for the Trump era, and this is in Rue's writing, a trenchant critique of academia's complicity in distorting and erasing indigenous cultures, and a deep dive into the mechanics of New Age spiritual abuse. In 1968, the University of California Press published Castaneda's first book, The Teachings of Don Juan. And in it, it describes his supposed encounters with a Yaqui shaman who initiated him into a secret world of peyote-fueled visions and ancient knowledge never before shared with a Westerner. Castaneda was quickly hailed as a revolutionary figure. Admirers ranged from John Lennon to Joni Mitchell to Federico Fellini, George Lucas, and Octavio Paz. In books, he became an international best-selling author, and his books were bestsellers and remain the most popular titles ever published on Native American spirituality, despite having little to no connection to actual indigenous practices. With the endorsement of some of anthropology's leading figures, his work at first went unchallenged. Then in 1973, Time magazine published a searing expose revealing that Castaneda wasn't who he claimed to be, and his academic credibility unraveled. He then turned inward, building a secretive cultic group that blurred the lines between fiction and reality. When Castaneda was diagnosed with liver cancer, he told his disciples he would not die, but burn from within and ascend to another realm, and invited them to join him. After his death in 1998, five of his closest female followers vanished. They are widely believed to have taken their own lives. Rue Marshall is a non-binary writer and visual artist, and their novel, A Separate Reality, was released by Carol N. Graf in 2006 and was nominated for a Lambda Award for debut fiction. Their writing has appeared in Salon, N Plus One, the Evergreen Review, the Kenyon Review, the Michigan Quarterly Review, Waxwing, the Barcelona Review, Your Impossible Voice, another Chicago magazine, and many other publications. They have twice been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and received the 2016 Hazel Rowley Prize from BIO, the Biographers International Organization. Their visual work has been exhibited at Participant Incorporated, Studio 10 Gallery, Art in General, White Columns, Baxter Street, Cat House Proper, and numerous other venues. A prolific person, very talented. They have received grants and fellowships from McDowell, YADO, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and the New York Foundation for the Arts. And they grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and now live in the wonderful Brooklyn. Here is Rue now. Marshall is with me today. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you and to be able to hear about your book, American Trickster, by Orr Publishing, all about Carlos Castaneda. And I have actually had some clients over the years who dealt with Carlos Castaneda personally and got involved in his group and found themselves caught up in something that was head spinning and not what they expected, and he was not who they thought he was, and it turned their life upside down. So it's one of these stories that has sort of been with me over the years, and every once in a while someone stops in to get some help because of the experiences there. And I know we're also going to go in different areas, different directions, cover a lot of different topics. But I also love that you've just written so much about really important subjects. So I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself to the listeners, and then we'll start talking.
Hi, I'm Rue Marshall. I wrote American Trickster, The Hidden Lives of Carlos Castaneda. My background is as a visual artist and novelist. And then somehow I spent 20 years writing this book about Carlos Castaneda. And here we are.
Here we are. And I'm so glad we are. So this is a name that a lot of people have heard of. Some people have not. But the people who have heard of him, I think, have this sense of a mystique of this person who was mysterious and also wise and this kind of spiritual, knowledgeable leader of sorts. It's very interesting when you start to pull back the curtain on someone and see that the wizard is someone very different, but also someone more complex than just a false god. There's a lot to this story, and there's a lot, I'm sure, that drew you to this story. So tell us what it was.
So glad you said that just to start off with, because there's such a tendency for people to either think, oh, this book is going to be some hagiography. I hope I'm saying that word right. Or it's just a complete takedown. And something that's very important for me is just to really understand the complexity of him and, you know, that people are not, you know, this whole tendency to think people are all good or all bad is a real problem. But how did I get into it? I had read the books very, very long time ago. I started when I was in middle school, and as were many people, my mind was blown. But then at a certain point, I smelled something wrong. I was like, there's something not right about this. And then I forgot about it for maybe 30 years. And then I was working on a novel, which was basically a queer crisis of faith novel. That was my elevator pitch for it. And somehow or another, he kept coming up, not as, you know, the person who he was, but the influence of his books or the influence they had on me, which I think was subterranean and greater than I had ever thought it was. When that book, it's called A Separate Reality, I'm going to pitch that too, came out, my agent suggested that I write some kind of just short nonfiction piece to go along with it. And my first thought was, whatever happened to Carlos Castaneda? That was in 2006. And I began to just hunt around on the internet. And I came across a little article about the discovery of the skeleton of his adopted daughter and lover, Nuri Alexander, in Death Valley. And I was like, oh my God, what? And then pretty soon after that, I did some more digging and I got in touch with a woman named Amy Wallace, who had also been one of his lovers and had written a memoir. I was on the phone with her for 3 hours. I could not believe what I was hearing. And, you know, I liken it to what would you do if a spaceship landed in your backyard? It's like, oh, you could just go on and write the book that you were planning to write, or, well, maybe you should actually write about that spaceship. Somehow or another, I guess, because I'm a delusional person, I had no idea. I thought this would take 3 years to do. But the thing with Carlos is that every kind of rabbit hole has another rabbit hole in it. And I got to 3 years. I was like, oh, it'll take another 2 years. Then I was at 5 years and on and on and on. And at last, it's coming out very soon.
Wow. Wow. It's so exciting. When do you expect that it's going to be out?
It will be out in May. The official pub date, this is very confusing to me. The official pub date is in June, but if you order it, it will begin to ship from the publisher, from Or Books, should start the beginning of May.
May 2026. Wonderful.
Yeah, let's get the year in there too.
And just in case, if people are listening to this recently or in the future, one of the things that I find so interesting about certain personalities is that they have this web and they live this life that would exhaust me.
Oh my goodness, yes.
If I thought about all the people that go in and out of people's lives and all of the intrigue and the stories and the mysteries and the secrets, I'd be napping all day long if that were my life.
It would never be my life.
Absolutely not, right? I like my work. I like doing a podcast, but I don't need intrigue. I don't need secrets. keeping track of everything and all of the stories and who you're telling to what.
It's almost superhuman. It's extraordinary. The amount of energy. I'm so glad you brought that up because it's something I can't answer the question of why that is. But the drive behind it is not something that most people have. And it's something worth considering where that arises from.
It's very interesting. And I think about people in politics now. And I think about personalities like L. Ron Hubbard, who was building these naval ships and going off the coast because he wanted to evade laws in certain countries. And then he had certain countries after him and governments after him. And he just went about his day. There are some people, I think, who have certain personalities where they don't get riled up in the same way that we might. In fact, it takes a lot, actually, to make them get exhausted or upset. They can operate at this sort of crescendo level, but constantly, and ignore a lot. And also sometimes ignore the damage that they're doing because they don't often look back. They just keep moving forward and they don't necessarily see the wreckage. When you have more of a conscience-driven life, I think you get bogged down, but in a good way, by thinking about the impact you've had on people and reviewing conversations. I don't know Carlos Castaneda's personality nearly as well as yours, just from what I've heard, but it just seems like he just plowed forward in his life and just left wreckage along the way. And I don't know how much it mattered.
Absolutely. And it's something I try to explore in the book. My conclusion is that he made himself do that. I don't believe that always came easily with him. And one of the things that I think is unique about Castaneda is that because he was so intelligent and because he wrote so much, even though it comes to us in a very kind of coded manner, I think there is a lot to explore about the psychology of a charismatic narcissist, or if you will, you know, a sociopath. I don't know, you know, entirely how meaningful these categories are, but, you know, he certainly fits into both of those. People will remember these endless dialogues with Don Juan. We can return to all of the reasons that we know that Don Juan is a fictional creation, but Carlos is talking to himself. One thing that immediately comes to mind is Carlos had basically an adopted son. He had had a vasectomy and he had another man, you know, impregnate his wife for him. And his plan was to raise this boy as a little warrior, that he too would become a sorcerer. And when it turned out that the son, you know, was just basically a regular human being, Carlos jettisoned him. But there is a great deal of what I would understand as an internal back and forth in the books where he's almost talking himself into the need to do it. So I can't generalize beyond the thing that I know about, which is Castaneda. But there's this almost will to consider other people as unreal. When I go back into his early childhood, and there are, you know, instances where it's like, no, I don't think he was someone who from birth saw other human beings entirely in an instrumental way. But I'm trying to peel apart the psychology that led him to the point where it began to become for him a necessity to have other people not be real and to come up with a reason, you know, an excuse, an ideology for, as you say, just leaving the wreckage behind and not looking back.
It's so interesting. I run a lot of support groups along with the clinical work that I do. Some support groups that are very specific for particular groups, people who have left particular cultic groups, and one general one for former cult members and for families also who have loved ones who are ensnared in something or in a certain narcissistic relationship and can't free themselves. One of the things that I hear a lot from these people who have left is that they had to learn to feel. They had to learn to have compassion for their fellow man and woman after leaving the group, that they learned not to have that sense that people's feelings mattered, that sorrow mattered, that pain mattered. One of the things that they talk about is that it's so nice to now be connected as a human being in the world, but how painful it is that you're now feeling what other people are feeling and that you need to care and you need to sometimes sit with their sorrow or the pain that they're in. I'm wondering if there was a part of him that didn't want to feel or found it too hard to feel. And if so, it was easier to think of human beings as unreal. Because I don't know his history and I don't know what would make him want to protect himself from that level of emotion.
Obviously, I'm not a therapist and I don't have the kind of experience you have across different groups. But there was a model that I came across in writing about Carlos that, of all of the things that I had read, fit so well with his biography. And it's from a guy named Len Oakes. He's an Australian psychologist or psychiatrist, and he wrote a book about, I think it's called Prophetic Charisma. I may be getting that title wrong. But the pattern that he traces out is a child who is idolized and adored very early on, which Carlos was. His mother put him way up on a pedestal. And, you know, I could go into some of the deep reasons behind that. And then they have to confront the fact that they are just people. That does not hold. And then Oakes traces this across different groups. There comes a point where there is a very humiliating instance, and that certainly happened with Castaneda when he was 18 years old. And he had been a very, very good boy. He was born on Christmas Day, Christmas Eve. Being born on Christmas Day didn't help him. That absolutely fed into his idea of himself as very special. But these like older kids come, or these kind of bully kids come and get him and this other boy. They force them to get drunk. Castaneda then goes to midnight mass, vomits on the priest, and he is expelled from his hometown. His father makes sure that he leaves. He's gone by the next morning. He never gets over this. He writes about it cryptically. Everything is in the books, but it's cryptically encoded. Back to the model that I was sketching out, there are competing versions, you know, of the self, and I think we all have that. We're not unitary beings. And among them is this version that you are the special one, the chosen one. I don't think Castaneda entirely believed that at first, but he toyed with it, and he writes this book. He is basically a dropout from the grad program. He's driving a taxi cab in Los Angeles. He writes this very strange book that then becomes an international bestseller. And he's being feted by the New York Times. And he is the most famous anthropologist on the planet. That might just contribute to your thinking, well, actually, maybe I am the chosen one. And then it's at that point, according to the model that Oakes lays out, that that becomes set. And from then on, anything that is going to disrupt that narrative has to be pushed out. I mean, I think Constantine certainly had this earlier on, but on a much smaller scale, but he needed other people, primarily women, but not entirely women, to continually, constantly reinforce this narrative, and hence you get a cult. And to skip ahead to the end, it keeps growing and growing, and the myth keeps growing, and he keeps pushing it, and he's more and more surrounded by people who will just reinforce whatever he says. This can be traced back pretty early. He told people this, you know, when he was at UCLA, that he was not going to die. So who knows?
I'm now remembering that. And even when he had cancer, also, he wasn't going to die.
He wasn't going to die, but he could not ever be alone. He always needed to have this kind of reinforcement. So the myth was that, and this is something that happens in the books with Don Juan, is that he departs the earth with this magical sorcerer's party. And Castaneda was not going to go alone. And five women disappeared following his death. The skeleton of one of them, who I spoke about before, was later found. And let's just say it, all of the evidence tells us that they took their lives in order to accompany him. So it's kind of extreme.
Yeah. I can see how compelling the story is because it's about this charismatic leader, but it's also a very human story about the fear of loneliness, the fear of not mattering, of not being remembered.
On the broader sense, who doesn't relate to that? Who doesn't in this world fear that their life is meaningless, at least in the Western world or the world that I know? And a figure like Castaneda may in some way be kind of an extreme case of that, but in their providing this complete, totalizing answer to that, there's no lack of meaning in those books. And that's why they appeal so much. That's why they appealed to me, that if you are feeling that your life doesn't have a point or that you're unimportant, these books will lure you in with this kind of tremendous sense of importance that they give to the path that you are on. And they're very clever. He's very smart because he gets you to identify with this character, Carlos, in the books, who in a way has very little to do with the real Castaneda. And it's one of the many reasons you can say, well, yeah, they're novels, because he presents himself in the books as this very stolid, boring, rationalist anthropologist, which, you know, anyone who knew him at the time was no, not at all. But he creates this protagonist that you project yourself onto.
That's so fascinating. The whole idea also about a fear of being alone. I was recently talking about this. I don't remember if it was on the podcast or if it was a video I was doing, because I do some videos for YouTube. But it was this idea that I've come to from hearing it over and over again. I think that while you as a follower think that you really need this person and you can't live without them, it's very often the reverse that is more pronounced. They can't live without you. They need you sometimes more than you need them, because ultimately you don't really get from them what you were hoping for or needing. A lot of it is sort of smoke and mirrors to a certain degree, but they really, really, really need you.
I would say that's absolutely true, but that you can't see that at first. It appears entirely, it's almost like a negative image of that that is presented to you. I doubt that you will disagree with this, but just think it's really important to say again and again that this just can happen to anybody. These people who were drawn into this were not particularly vulnerable. They were often more intelligent than average. They were very highly educated people. But Castaneda had, as it were, a sixth sense for in moments of vulnerability. And he would wait sometimes an extraordinary period of time. And he specialized in women who had lost their fathers. And he would swoop in at that moment. And that's what he did with Amy Wallace, who I mentioned earlier, whom he had known for something like 20 years before her father died. And he knew that was the moment to ensnare her. And he did this over and over again. But going back to what you started with about, there's an incredible amount, the effort, the energy that goes into that. However much I theorize about it, it's very hard to account for that with someone, because, you know, as I say to people, running a cult, it's a lot of work. That need that they must have, as you were saying, to have all of these people around them, it is obviously a need. It's a drive. It takes an incredible amount of effort to continually keep constructing that.
Right. It's almost like it's the oxygen they need to breathe. On a daily basis, from some of these personalities that I've met over time, that they need almost daily to be reminded of these messages that they're not alone, and they will keep constructing and reconstructing.
It's never enough. It's like the Mary Trump book, Too Much But Never Enough. And the parallels, I don't think for Trump, it's ever enough. He's president, and then he needs to win the Nobel Prize, and he needs to build a ballroom. It's not ever going to be sufficient. And it was not ever going to be sufficient for Carlos either. You have to keep expanding it. Then at a certain point, that may run into reality, whether it be political reality or, you know, in Castaneda's case, that actually, no, he was not going to turn into a ball of light and ascend into the heavens. He had liver cancer. He was just another mortal. And that was impossible to take in.
I'm sure that you have people in your life, friends you've come across, people you've been with, where I'm going to guess, because people come across these personalities where they're trying so hard and you want to say, it's okay. You have friends. Life is good. You don't have to be the most entertaining person in the room. You don't have to be the flashiest dresser. Just be. But that there are some people who don't ever want to take the risk of not being the most fill in the blank, because without that, they might feel that they're nothing, which is sad. I would feel a lot more sad for personalities like Trump if he didn't do the damage that he did. I would look at it more psychologically.
I'm not sitting around feeling really sad for him every day. And it just certainly wasn't, you know, my central intent in writing the book. But I did, especially, you know, the more and more time I spent with him, I think it's important for us to understand that our monsters are also human beings, and to understand, you know, that potential for a little bit of monstrousness in all of us. This is just my opinion, that certainly I've engaged in demonizing of people. Of course, I do that, but I don't think that really serves us to understand. It may be, you know, that in your work or dealing with other figures, you know, there are people where it is just, they are entirely figures straight from hell. But partly what I found interesting is that even with someone who ruined many people's lives, did terrible things to him, that there is humanity in it too.
And I think it's important to look at that. When I tell people that if someone has been abused and then they abuse you, it's not an excuse, but there is a reason, that you want to understand the reason. They still need to not do this to other people. They still need to get help when they realize that this is what they're doing to other people. And also, just as a caveat, when we talk about Trump, and this is something I've said before because I've gotten some mail on this, that I'm not speaking politically. This is a case study about psychology, about what can happen, and about insatiable need and where that can lead. And it's boundless. And that's when it can get dangerous. Going back to what we're saying, the fact that you're wanting to understand his humanity, understand him, it's reminding me of the story you told about him throwing up on the priest, which is a horrible, horrible thing. But just to be cast out because of that, it happens so often that there is a punitive response to those moments as opposed to a finding out why. What happened? Why are you throwing up? That was probably not your intention, but, oh, you're drunk. How did you get drunk? What happened to you? And you were forced to do this, that there was no compassion. There was no understanding. There was just a punishment. And so it sounds like you're wanting to approach him in the same way, not just to be punitive, but to kind of get him and to understand, which I think is showing your humanity too, which is really important. What else do you find compelling about him, and also the damage that he did that I think is important for people to know?
There are kind of broader sorts of cultural damage that, you know, we need to pay attention to. And one is simply that his books remain, as far as I can tell, the best selling books ever about indigenous spirituality. That's a scandal because they do not actually have much, if anything, to do about that. What he's doing in the books is he is putting the words both of one professor in particular, who I'd be very happy to talk about, but also of German phenomenology and Nietzsche in the mouth of this indigenous shaman. There's a book by Philip DeLoria called Playing Indian about how white people use Native American people to work out their own issues and fantasies. There's that kind of, might be a little extreme to call it cultural genocide, but you get the idea. On a broad cultural level, those books, it's hard to trace influence, but there is, you know, within that great kind of idealistic moment, the 60s and the 70s, and people are having these incredible psychedelic experiences, and there's this sense of great promise, we can change the world. There's always sort of a tension between the communal, which was, you know, what Timothy Leary was like, you know, we're all gonna, you know, the state will dissolve, but we're all gonna love each other, we're gonna have world peace. Castaneda was not into peace. He was not into love. He considered those both to be forms of weakness. He was influenced by Nietzsche. He was influenced by Sartre. He was interested in the individual, this idea of the superior individual soul who will rise above everybody else. It has more to do with Ayn Rand than to do with Timothy Leary or somebody like that. And Castaneda, to the extent that he did have politics, which was not great, but to the extent that he did, they would have been really right-wing. And that kind of stuff is insidious. Stuart Brand, who wrote the Whole Earth Catalog, which was very influential in the early days of Silicon Valley, he was a big Castaneda fan. These ideas, there's a kind of a conduit into this Silicon Valley culture where the tech bros become the masters of the universe and where you can create your own reality.
Also, this detachment and what that affords you, I think, being able to just make it through the day. I mean, it sounds like emotions were difficult for him, maybe even overwhelming.
Probably. He was an absolute control freak, and he is a sexual predator. He tells these women to commit suicide to follow into the next dimension. He tells people to join his group, you need to cut off your family, change your name, quit your job, get rid of your dog, all of that. But maybe the most shocking thing in the book, at least to a lot of people, is he probably almost never or maybe never used drugs. And this is the guy who was one of the great heroes of the psychedelic era. There's only one eyewitness account that I came across of him ever actually using drugs, and that's Datura, and he does it wrong, and nobody gets high.
There's a lot when people do different kinds of psychedelics. I mean, sometimes it is to enhance things. Sometimes it's to go somewhere else so that you're not present, you're not feeling, you're not dealing with real life, if real life is hard for you. I'm so curious about his personality and also about the destructiveness.
Talking about the damage that he did, there's the very dramatic damage that was done, you know, in particular to these women. But there's also, you know, when working on this book, I've ended up talking to so many people who had much more casual relationship to him or to the books. And there's this kind of damage that was just expressed to me by a lot of people of being put on a path that never took them anywhere. People who have remembered the books or have read the books may recall, again, this kind of emphasis on the importance of being solitary, the solitary bird, the solitary warrior, and it's constantly fed to you in subtle or not so subtle ways that all of those, I call them, you know, the muggles in your life, those boring people, those ordinary people at work, your parents, your spouse, your children, they are really holding you back from this quest. And even, you know, for people who did not become involved in the actual cult, just the readers who were, you know, in some kind of expanded sense part of it, people who just often spent years and years on this path, and then it went nowhere. There was nothing. In the books, it's kind of Castaneda's version of grace. I'm not against the concept of grace, but in Castaneda's books, it's basically you have to be chosen. Don Juan has to find you. There's this endless stuff about how you search for something while not searching for something. I am a person who is interested in spirituality. I meditate at least twice daily. All of this stuff matters to me, and thus the corruption of it matters. That affected a lot of people. Like, what did I just do for the last 10 years? What happened to me?
Such an interesting insight, too, as you're talking about it, that you are a spiritual person and you meditate twice a day, which is a big practice in your life, and it matters to you. There are people who will say that sometimes when people are critical of people who are doing what he was doing, it's that it's an oversimplification, that they're just sort of against religious leaders and against spirituality, or not at all. It's similar to why it bothers me so much when people come to me because they were just misused by another therapist, that the therapist had the need to hold them as clients and to overdiagnose them because they needed to be needed. And it gets under my skin because this is my field and it matters to me. I like that you have this viewpoint that you're not against it. You're just seeing the perversion of it.
Not at all. But I think, you know, if you're going to be someone who defends the importance and the potential ability to change oneself and the world of faith and of these explorations, you've really also got to be critical of the abuse. Castaneda is, at this point, my specialty. It's pretty clear that there's very widespread abuse in the spiritual world and in the New Age world, even within Buddhism, that needs to be addressed, because we're not going to move forward unless we look at that. I'm not an expert on this, but there's a whole Deepak Chopra thing that's been going on, and I don't necessarily hear a lot of people, you know, stepping up to the plate to own that. And people in academia, which is, it's not the spiritual world, there's been a big failure to own up to what happened with Carlos.
So one of the support groups that I mentioned before is actually specifically through an organization called Heartwood, and it's for people who were abused by their Buddhist gurus. And there are people in it who are Buddhists still, who are monks, who care, who want to be able to preserve what's good about it, but also can see that power can be taken advantage of. It all depends upon who's doing it and also what permission they give themselves to cross those boundaries, and that there aren't safeguards in place, which is the other part that really is problematic. And just like with Carlos Castaneda, that he could get away with it for so long, which also shows a lack of safeguards. I see that also with our government, lack of safeguards, to have a president who's impeached twice and it doesn't matter. These things should matter. There should be some safeguard. I wonder about him with the damage that he did, but also, as you're saying, that he sent people on these sort of wild goose chases. And I don't mean to belittle it by calling it something kind of fun like that, because it's devastating. It's devastating to give up everything to go on this journey.
It just went nowhere, because the only place that it ever is really going to go is to Castaneda, is to him swooping in and transforming your life. And one of the very tricky things that he does is that there's this widespread questioning of authority in the 1960s and the 1970s that was very much justified. And he gets you to question all sorts of things that you have taken for granted or that you have been told about what the world is like. But then there's this turn of the screw, I guess, where this new authority comes in. It's introduced to us as Don Juan, which we're going to respect because, oh, it's, you know, this moment at which the old indigenous wise man, there's a lot of reason for people to want that, but it's actually Carlos. There is no Don Juan. It's very sneaky. And just one thing, responding a little to what you were saying before, that I found very interesting and I think is really important is just the way that when you get people to invest in something, you get them to invest emotionally in it or their careers. And then there's a whole little world of people who do that, which was true at UCLA and then would be true in the cult and is true now, both on the left and the right, that people are isolated in these bubbles where everyone around them is thinking more or less the same thing, that it is tremendously hard to be the first person to say, something is not right here. And I just think this can't be stressed enough that these cult leaders or charismatic narcissist people, they know, Carlos knew this, that what you think does not matter that much. Your reason is always going to be trumped by emotion. Castaneda, his first great critic was this guy named Richard B. DeMille, you know, who said Castaneda, he didn't so much fool the people at UCLA as he seduced them. And he did it because, and this is something I suspect you know more about than I do, he had this preternatural ability to know what people needed, what they wanted to hear, to reflect it back to them in this way that made them feel great. It made them feel really, really good, even if it was just on the level that their theories were being validated by a shaman. That was amazing. And then once you have been sucked into that, to turn around and say, oh, I was wrong. And I try to make it a practice, but I'm not all that good about it. Like, oh, if I know I've been wrong about something, to admit it, because nobody does. Look on the internet. Does anyone ever say, I was wrong? No, we're in a big mess.
When I work with families, also, there are a lot of parents who won't apologize and won't affirm that maybe their child was right about feeling what they were feeling. And I think they're afraid of doing that and they're afraid that it's a weakness. And it actually is this great strength. It takes courage. It's unfortunate that it takes courage because we're socialized to think that it's a weakness. But there are people who are in their 70s, 80s, even 90s who will say to me, the one regret is that I never heard my parents say, I'm sorry. And so it is a very powerful thing. But yes, there are people who are like Carlos's personality where it either wouldn't occur to them or they can't take the risk. Because they have to stay with their story, I think, that they were right.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise they're just going to collapse completely. Again, he had to be special. He had to be, and it's in the first pages of the teachings of Don Juan, which it's really interesting to me that no one noticed this at the time, that Don Juan tells him that he is the chosen man or the chosen one. And it's like, wow, this didn't set off any kind of alarm bells. He also tells him that he is a student of the devil, but that's woven in very cleverly. He's a very clever, clever writer. So it's easy to miss that because you're reading for what you want to be there.
It's interesting being the chosen one. I don't know why my head is going to the life of Brian, but I'm thinking of people... No, please stop. There are some people where their personalities, it's anathema. It's just, it's so uncomfortable. Don't, please don't see me this way. too much pressure. I'm not the guy. Mm-mm. And you shouldn't just have one person. But there are some people who do welcome it, need it, conjure it, maintain it. Again, it's from afar, you find it sad and insatiable. But when you're in it, you can see how much you're going to be caught up in it. I wonder also with him being able to really work people, do you think that what made his words compelling was because he had this aura? So people thought that they were hearing something that was from on high when he complimented them, that it had more weight?
There are a lot of levels to that, and it also depends at what point in his career. But he was obviously extremely charming. He exuded this confidence that people of this ilk have, that it's a powerful thing because you can see yourself mirrored. There's a shamelessness in that, you know, with pretty much any woman that he was interested in, which was not all women. He wanted you to be, beside beautiful, to be very smart and to be powerful. It was no challenge to him if you were somebody who seemed weak. You had to be a challenge. And then he would come at you about what an incredibly special soul you were. He had never met anybody like you. Your energy was going to be transformative. And there's this little group. We need you because we're on this mission. What the mission is always, you know, remains just a little bit out of reach. And you think you're just about to get it, but you're not quite there. Same thing that happens in the books. There's something that's just around the corner. We're almost there. You've almost learned how to see. That's the big phrase in the early books. Will Carlos, the character, learn how to see? He's almost just about to see, but not quite. And he's doing something, you know, with these women, but also with his professors. So he made you feel really special, really special. He was also hilarious, which may not be a thing that all of these people have in common, but I was told so many times, like, oh, I don't even remember what we were talking about. We were laughing so hard. He had me on the floor laughing. And then he would slip in things there, but people was like, oh, who even cares? Because we were having so much fun. And just going to the issue of complexity, you know, someone was asking me the other day, was he always a liar? Was he born a liar? And I don't know, because what he was maybe born as was a great storyteller. And when he's a kid, he would gather the other kids, would come to hear him tell ghost stories at night in the plaza. They'd run away, they would be terrified by it. He loved to create these fabulous other realities. He, I think, needed to live in those fabulous other realities. And then as he gets older, that begins to segue into things that you would maybe more accurately characterize as cons, but they're always both there. He could do things to people that were really horrible and deceitful. And there's a story I tell about when he's leaving Peru to come to the United States that he tells one of his best friends that they're going to meet in Rio de Janeiro. And this friend, it's insane, treks across Bolivia to meet Carlos there, and Carlos has gone to Los Angeles instead. So he's doing really fucked up things. But then at the same time, people are delighted by him because it's fun. I heard, you know, there's one girl who's a young girl, knew him, you know, in the 1950s. It was like, oh, it was so much fun to be with him because she would just enter his fantasy land. And maybe on some level with children, he was kind of at home because he could play with them. And when adults would play with him, great. When you didn't want to play anymore, watch out.
So I want to get to the watch out part. First, I'm reminded as you're talking about all this fantasy stories, I hear that a lot about people who are cult leaders. And in fact, a story that I remember hearing by a woman named Hannah Whitfield, who was one of the sub-captains on one of L. Ron Hubbard's ships, and that late at night, I think he would drink rum. I think rum was his drink. And he would lay down on the deck and have people lay down and look up at the stars. And they would point to a star and he would tell them what that planet is called and what language they speak. And he would imitate the language as though he knew it. And it was a different language for each star that was pointed at. And it was unbelievable. And it was so engaging.
You have to kind of admire that on a certain level, or not admire, but be impressed by it.
It's destructive, and it's a certain kind of creative genius, I think.
I mean, it's destructive if you insist that it's real, because it's basically showtime never ends with Carlos. There's a performance that's going on, and the performance is incredibly entertaining, but you never get to go off stage. You never get to just go home and be normal.
Incredible. And then also, before we get to the watch out part, because I want to know what the watch out means, this idea that you're almost there, this carrot that's dangled, like you're not quite there yet, or you don't fully understand yet, this idea that something is out of your reach is so compelling, but it can create such an addiction. People get very caught up in this sunk cost fallacy, like I've spent all this time and I've made all these sacrifices.
Exactly. And the longer you're in it, the worse it is.
So tell me about the watch out. What would happen if people didn't go along?
It starts with his first wife, you know, Margaret, who up to a point was willing to play with him, but she was there when he was inventing Don Juan and she didn't buy it. Basically, you're banished. And that can happen whether you are a member of the inner circle. There was a woman, Judy, she changed her name numerous times. She gave up her children, left behind her entire life to follow him. The other thing in Carlos is maybe a little bit unique is that characters in the book become people in the cult. He creates these corresponding worlds. And the later books are bewildering often, but one way to read them is this is just cult management where one of the witches is in ascent because she's in favor in the actual real world group living in Westwood. However, Judy O, by the mid-1980s, there's this episode somebody told me about was like going out to a restaurant with them and he was talking, saying, oh, I was just in Mexico with Don Juan. And she just goes, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. She's thrown out. They put her in a psychiatric hospital. I don't know whether she's still living or not, but ends up living 10 minutes away from him. He puts her in this apartment. She's banished. One of the witches will like go and, you know, maintain contact with her. But later on, they start having these seminars and these workshops and thousands of people are attending and she would come and sit in the back and they would pretend not to see her and he would tell horrible stories about you. One week you're a princess, but then however it is that you've shown that you're not completely in on it, or sometimes for another reason, just for arbitrary cruelty or whatever, you will be completely degraded. You will be told, you know, the spirit has spit you out. That was something he told one woman who was thrown out of the group. She was devastated by that. People became suicidal because they have been built up and built up and built up. They're part of this very special cadre. We alone know what's going on and have the truth. Everyone else is nothing. And that becomes more extreme over time. These other people who are not with us, they're apes. You are magical beings. And then, bam, you're no longer a magical being. You're worthless and no one will speak to you.
I sometimes think of it as sort of spiritual game of chutes and ladders. You get to a certain place, and I don't know, I remember playing this game even with my kids, and it was such a frustrating game because you could work so hard to get to a certain point and then just lose it all. And the same thing with these kinds of cultic groups and with these kinds of personalities, there isn't allegiance and you don't accrue points and it doesn't matter that you have done so much. And that is also so devastating.
And it's so manipulative because everyone is terrified of it.
That's true too, right? Because if you see it happen to someone else so coldly, so easily, then you know it could happen to you.
And so you will not speak to that person because if somehow word gets out that you had contact with them, oh boy, you're going to be thrown out too. and you've left behind your family. The similarity between groups is so amazing. From what I read, they all pretty much do the friggin' same thing.
Right, including the public shaming. There's so much.
By then, he's gotten all of your secrets too. The honeymoon period during the seduction, he's gotten you to tell him all of the stuff that is most painful and embarrassing, and he will not hesitate to use that.
Right, and he probably then also knows what you're most sensitive about.
And he was very, very good at that. That's what people just told me over and over again. He knew how to read people. I think there's a good case to be made that he was no Don Juan, but he may very well have been psychic. I don't know whether you believe in that stuff. I'm not totally sure I do or not, but he just had that ability to know stuff about you, to just pick up on things and to read people.
When I talk about psychics with people, and who knows, there could be people out there who have certain powers that I don't know about, and I guess we'll see, but I feel like similar to when we're talking about a reversal, like that people who are cult leaders need their followers more than the followers need them. I feel like when people meet with a psychic, they are actually being read because they're giving information to the psychic without realizing it by their tells, the blinking eyes, the looking away, the hesitancy, the smile. So I think people know how to read people's faces and body language and a lot of things that you're offering to the psychic without realizing it. But it's an interesting thing. I'm curious about when he was at his biggest. You're saying that he had these big lectures where there were many, many people. So when he was at his pinnacle, what was his domain like? What was his world like?
Well, there are two pinnacles. There's a first pinnacle, which is when he's still in academia, his first four books from basically 1968 to 1974. He's really not being questioned in the media. He's receiving over and over again just superlative reviews. And then I could trace the whole thing, but it's actually Joyce Carol Oates writes a letter to the editor of the New York Times and says, "Am I the only person who thinks that these books are novels?" And very slowly it begins to unwind because once again, people in academia, at least a certain segment of academia, have invested a lot in them. And nobody wants to be the one that says, "Oh, Walter Goldschmidt, who's the head of the American Anthropological Association, was totally had." There's just real power politics. That's probably his real pinnacle. But then as things, you know, go downhill, he's all along been forming at first this very small cultic group, which just starts as, I think, two women. But by the late 80s and early 90s, he starts going. He has these women who are known as the witches, and they have this thing called tensegrity, which they claim is a martial arts technique passed down by 25 generations of Toltec shamans, which in fact, they're often just making up the movements in the hotel room before they go on stage. But people are told that if you practice tensegrity really hard, if you're impeccable, which was one of his favorite words and a very problematic concept, if you are impeccable, you may not have to die. You will be able to join this warrior's party and dodge this being called the eagle, which is devours consciousness, blah, 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 blah. So yeah, eternal life starts being promised. They start holding workshops and seminars. And in the 90s, thousands of people come to see the show. A portion of them go all the way. You know, he starts having an incomprehensible number of women who he is sleeping with, who are kept in apartments, you know, around the Los Angeles area. Around 1996, he begins showing signs of illness. It turns out that he has liver cancer, once again, because they don't believe in the concept of illness. They just believe in weakness of the will. That has to be denied. I don't know if they wanted to start a religion per se, but they wanted to create this myth that he had just evanesced. You know, when he died, they basically tried to keep it secret. They wanted it to just be, oh, these women, you know, they just vanished. Of course, they did not just evanesce. into the air.
Incredible. The idea also that people who don't know can believe that someone is presenting them with something that is from an ancient practice.
It's also because we're so incredibly ignorant about basically anything south of the border. And he early on figured that out. And he was just like, how can I keep expanding the envelope? And then some how to appreciate Carlos level, you have to be like, oh, he was just like, oh my God, these gringos are such idiots. Even those who were among the leading academic figures of their time, they had no idea about anything.
And it sounds like he made sure to limit any dissension or questioning anyway. So even if you were wondering, you knew not to say it out loud. These stories are reminding me of other cases that I've dealt with where there's a woman who was involved in a Rastafarian kind of cult. Not that Rastafarian spirituality is a cult. And that it was her job, and she could never reveal this, but the leader had clip-on dreadlocks. And he was just some guy. I think he was from Milwaukee. And he put on an accent and she would clip on his dreads. And he would go out and he was this god. It was really amazing when you see behind the scenes. And you saw a lot of behind the scenes here. And I'm wondering also, just because I know we're running short on time, which I'm upset about because there's so much to talk about. And I'd love to talk to you again, maybe after your book comes out, and that would be really fun to talk again. But in the meantime, there are a lot of people who are what we call cult apologists. And I would love to talk a little bit about that, because there are people who will say something is a cultic group. Others will say there's no such thing.
Let me tell you my story about my run-in with a cult apologist. My book was sold to University of California in 2019. University of California was his original publisher, continues to publish the teachings of Don Juan, and continues to publish it as Native American Studies. The manuscript was enormous. I was instructed to cut it enormously and went out for outside review. I got 3 positive reports, but there were some suggestions. I spent 2 years cutting 100,000 words from the book, trying to make these changes, and resubmitted it 2 years later, and then my editor quit. I got bounced up to the big boss. The first editor said it's all going to be smooth sailing going forward. It was absolutely not smooth sailing. The book went back to the editorial committee to an anthropologist. As far as I can tell, one guy read the book, was very offended by my criticism of anthropology and said things like, oh, Marshall misuses the word magic, which there's maybe one place where I use it in a kind of technical sense. Otherwise, it was a magical night, or she thought it was a magical night. So then, okay, getting to the cult apologists, it got sent out for a second round. This time, high marks on the anthropology, but it goes to a sociologist of religion, which, who knew? As you probably knew, sociology of religion has been dominated by the cult apologists for, more than 30 years. They try to see the books that dissent from their position, which is that cults are nothing other than persecuted minority religions, that those people do not get published. He wrote a 7,000-word takedown of my book. I had to spend the next 6 months rebutting that and then waiting for a third round of reports. And I just think, when somebody tells these women that they need to kill themselves in order to travel into the next dimension and live into infinity, it was really okay to use the word cult. Really think so. Basically, a big hunk of my life went into that. And then on the third round, it's like, you're right. That's okay to talk about cults. But we want you to cut another 50,000 words from this book than we'd agreed to the previous summer. And we need you to work back in this material that you took out after the first round. And we still can't guarantee that further objections will not be raised when it goes out again. And somewhere within then, I had probably made the error of saying, oh, do you guys have any plans to change how you contextualize the teachings of Don Juan? I would never be asking them to not publish it. I don't believe in censorship. I think bad books should still be out there. But I think there is some kind of obligation to let the reader know what it is, because obviously these books have consequences, and people who were in the cult told, you know, this would never have happened had it not been for that initial imprimatur of the University of California. The answer was basically, no, we're not going to change anything. I was like, I don't really know that you guys are ever going to publish the book or that it's ever going to come out in any kind of form resembling what I had written. So anyway, okay, that was my run-in with that.
Wow. So looking at it psychologically, I am wondering, what are they afraid of? I can't imagine what the worry is. Yeah, and you're right. When we are talking about people dying for something or being encouraged, we're dealing with things like Heaven's Gate in San Diego or dealing with Jonestown.
I find the denial stunning. I mean, I think there are things like, okay, it's not, again, as if there's no point to it. There have been excesses in the anti-cult movement. I'm not an expert on Waco, but, you know, I understand the argument that anti-cult hysteria may have led to people dying at Waco. I understand that it is very easy to take people who have weird beliefs and call them a cult, and that's not good. Don't do it. But what the social psychologists, what I'm sure you know, people who sit, you know, across the street from the sociologists in the psychiatry department know is that the sociologists' religions say, oh, these are just, you know, new religious movements. But these are movements that often have nothing at all to do with religion. They are these kind of social formations that are very kind of specific in their form. The definition I have in the book is that it's a group. The underlying core purpose, no matter what the beliefs are, whether it is in Save the Dolphins or socialism or Donald, whatever, it's about the aggrandizement of a leader or maybe a small group of leaders at the expense, primarily the psychological expense, of everybody else. And the fact that this exists and that it, you know, we are seeing the consequences of this in our society needs to be talked about. But it is crazy to me that these people have as much power and put the kibosh on the publishing of views that dissent with theirs.
Incredible. And I love your definition. And it's true. I don't think there's anyone who benefits from being involved in a cult. Makes perfect sense.
That's kind of the definition. I don't want to speak too sloppily, but there's kind of something a little bit cultic about this denial. I mean, not, you know, that I would anyway call it a cult per se, but it is this closed circle of belief that refuses to take in any evidence outside of it, which is, I think, is something that is incumbent on all of us, no matter what we believe, whether we're on the left or on the right or believe in God or don't believe in God, is to, you know, really try to work to take in some uncomfortable things, which in the age of the internet becomes very hard because we're creating these bubbles that are, whether or not they're actually cults, they mimic that kind of dynamic.
Also, to just give you such a headache to have to deal with, you know, and all you're doing is saying, here's this really interesting character study.
There's no sense of ethical responsibility, no sense that what they do have some kind of consequences in actual people's lives, that people outside of the academy actually read, you know, millions of people read that book and that it had an impact on them. I don't know. I mean, at a certain point, they made a lot of money off of it. It's hard for me to believe they're still making a lot of money off of it. Maybe they're making some or they wouldn't still publish it. And then there's also that weird institutional loyalty where I don't even think it's about any one individual. It's almost just because they are a part of this institution and the institution cannot accept that it made a damn mistake. And there's no mechanism in academia for that. It's a very catch-22 because they'll say, well, it was approved by the experts back in 1968, so we have no choice. There's no mechanism for later reviewing it. Again, to mention Richard DeMille, who was Costanita's early critic, wrote an article called The Invisibility of Scientific Scorn. Well, everybody may in academia have come to the point where like, oh, that's ridiculous. But there's no mechanism whereby you could, for example, take away his PhD or change the way that that book is presented to the public.
Incredible. We could talk about this a long time. So I have to call this to a close. I'm so sorry. It's been delightful to talk to you.
By the way, I'm going to be in, I think it's January 12th, I'm going to be in Los Angeles reading at the Figueroa. I'm not from LA, probably saying that wrong, and orbooks.com.
Nice. Wonderful. It was so good to talk to you. And everyone, pick up a copy of this book when it comes out. And there's so much other writing that you've done. So everyone, look up Rue Marshall online, find out all the good things and the little tasty bits that you've put out throughout the years. And it's wonderful. And it's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Likewise.
One more thing before you go. It is so good to speak with someone so knowledgeable. Thank you so much to Rue and all of their research and tenacity and really being able to uncover something very interesting about a personality, someone who had found a way to charm so many people. In fact, when I was telling people that I was going to be doing a show about Carlos Castaneda, everyone said something positive. Oh, wow. That's great. Thinking I was going to be talking about somehow how incredible their work was and how groundbreaking and spiritual. That's not what this podcast was really covering at all. It was so much about the cult of personality and how people can come across a certain way to their public, to the public, in a way that's very different from how they are behind the scenes. I understand Rue's interest in this and how it is something that you can stay with for a long time. There's a lot to uncover, not only about personalities like Castaneda's, but about how much people are drawn to certain personalities, especially when they can tout a certain kind of expertise about a certain kind of spirituality or indigenous knowledge that you think is true because you have no frame of reference. You have no way of really knowing if it's true or not. And you might just think, not only is it something that you just haven't had the benefit of studying, but that also coming from a more spiritual and or liberal bent, you might think it's wrong of you to question when someone says they've had this history or this has been passed down to them through generations, that somehow you're not supposed to question that and it would be considered intolerant if you did it. So Castaneda benefited from a lot of the safeguards that are in place within certain social constructs. There is something so interesting about the fact that he sent people on these spiritual paths that went nowhere. I can't quite imagine doing that. I can't quite imagine feeling okay about doing that. That there are some people who don't mind doing that to other people. In fact, they love the fact that if they say jump, people will say how high, not why. If people were to question Castaneda, I'm sure, and why they needed to go on that kind of quest or that kind of journey just because he said, he might have made them feel really wrong for questioning him or that it was going to stand in the way of their spiritual development, the fact that they were somehow feeling in kind of a negative space about what he was gifting them with. There are so many ways that people are shut down. Their instincts are shut down. Their questioning is shut down. Their critical thinking is shut down. There's also something interesting about how much he was trying to come across like he was very spiritual and emotionally present and capable, but that he willed himself to see people as unreal. And when you will yourself to see people as unreal, I think, then what you're saying is, I don't want to have to care about them. I don't want to have to feel bad. I don't want to have to feel responsible because they're not real. If I've hurt them and they're sad, well, if they're not real, then I don't actually have to feel accountable for that. I also don't have to change what I'm doing. When people want to see others as unreal, really what they're saying is the reality of life, the reality of existential thinking, that we are all here together, that we have to deal with these things all together, the issues around life and death and freedom and all of the big hot ticket items, that for some people, it's too hard to think about. And they avoid it. And they avoid it by going into their bubble and by going into their magical thinking and inviting people in there with them, but that they never want to leave it. Because when they leave it, then they are going to have to think and they're going to have to feel and they're going to have to relate and they're going to have to sort of notice that the world is different than the one that they've sort of crafted in their own minds. And so many people who can come across like they have it all together are really in some way saying, I don't. And this is too much. And so I'm going to craft not only my own way of thinking, but my own world. I get to be in charge of. I get to decide how much I feel. I get to decide how much I care. I get to decide what other people do in my world. I also get to protect myself from being questioned by putting people down for questioning me, by publicly shaming them for questioning me. It is this very carefully crafted mode of self-protection. And most cult leaders create that. They create their own universes. When you are thinking, wow, what an incredible mind and what an incredible person who has put something together, you might also want to be thinking, what caused them to feel like they couldn't do this in the world outside? That they had to actually either build a compound and be the king of that or queen of that compound in that alternate universe, or that they have people who speak a certain kind of lingo, like we have our own language and we are then separate from the rest of society. Wonder, I think, what causes people, what drives people to feel that they need to live a life that's not in society, but that is rather a parallel universe, one they can control, one they can feel protected within, and one where they have the power to expel people who make them question, make them wonder, and make them really feel things that are uncomfortable for them to feel. These are very, very fascinating kinds of personalities to me, and they can be interesting if we look at them in just that more dispassionate social, psychological way. Very interesting people, but they can also be highly destructive when they cause people to have great harm, and they cause people to actually get derailed from their own lives in order to join them in their universe. Take good care, and thank you again to Rue, and I hope to be able to talk to them again and talk to you all next week. Take care.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections. And it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are three tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.